You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new UW-Madison study finds that educational materials developed by the Sesame Workshop can help children and caregivers cope with a parent's incarceration. The lead researcher joins the show coming up. First, since the coronavirus pandemic was declared a national emergency in March, the federal government has spent billions of dollars on things like protective equipment and testing supplies. Some of that money, though, was given out on no-bid contracts to companies that were brand new or had never produced medical equipment before. Some have returned faulty supplies, others haven't followed through at all. Ryan Gabrielson is an investigative reporter for ProPublica. He's been reporting on this story. Ryan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give us a sense of the scope and the scramble by the federal government to get this kind of equipment into hospitals fast?
Absolutely. So in the past 3 months, the federal government has spent a little over $16 billion on all manner of urgent supplies, whether it's PPE for hospital workers or for masks, gowns, but also to try to ramp up testing. So all manner of test kits and the supplementary materials that help that system function, from test tubes to swabs, transport media, which is the solution that keeps viruses alive inside the tubes. All of it had to be procured very, very quickly, and they basically had to be secured from nothing. The entire world was, these products were in demand everywhere, from China to Italy, all over Europe. A lot of the places that we manufacture them were holding on to them because they needed them as well, and were shutting down distribution. So the federal government not only desperately needed them, but had to find them from places that they wouldn't normally get them from. And of that $16 billion, approximately $2 billion of it went to first-time federal contractors, some of them very established players who just hadn't worked with the federal government before, but many of them people who had never worked in medical supplies, period.
Yeah, some of those were the focus of your reporting. What were some red flags that stuck out to you about some of these companies that just got into the federal contracting game and didn't have any background in this kind of medical supply market?
The most significant red flags were companies that had only just barely come into existence. I mean, so some of these contracts went to companies that had long existed, that existed for years and just were pivoting into something new. But some of them had only formed a matter of days or weeks in advance and suddenly were bidding on contracts. That was one of the most significant red flags for us. But even just cases where companies that had done something markedly different were now saying, trying to sell masks or gowns, vodka distributors, defense contractors that had advertised themselves as basically arms dealers, in a sense, were now getting into medical supplies. And in some cases, like I said, companies that had not existed in any shape or form beforehand were incorporating days before receiving multi-million dollar contracts.
Let's focus in on one company that you followed called Fill a Kit. They got a contract for what were supposed to be tubes for testing. Can you talk about that company and what it ended up delivering?
Absolutely. So Fill a Kit is one that stood out to us from the very, very beginning. They came into existence, they incorporated in the state of Florida, I believe it was on May 1st. And 7 days, 6 or 7 days later, they received a $10.1 million contract from FEMA to deliver testing supplies, which turned out to be the test tubes, test vials, and the solution that keeps viruses alive inside of it. Essentially 4 million units of that is part of the main federal support thrust to ramp up testing in the states. Fill a Kit has an interesting history. Obviously, it had no history itself because it had only come into existence on May 1st. But when there was no actual person attached to it besides a registered agent who was a lawyer in St. Petersburg, Florida, but the phone number attached to it when I did sort of a reverse lookup, it came up as Paul Wexler. Now, Paul Wexler has a long history. In 2013, he was hit by the FTC for allegedly fraudulent practices and robocalling as part of a credit counseling service that he was running at the time that had been selling services that they did not actually offer and allegedly defrauding all manner of people who were trying to reduce their debt loads. He was, as part of a settlement, hit it with a $2.7 million payment and also was barred from working in credit counseling or debt relief at all.
Now, his company did end up delivering something that was tube-shaped. Can you talk about what they ultimately ended up supplying and how it worked out?
Yes. So they actually started delivering, you know, one of the questions when we got started is well, what's the game here? Because assuming that because they can't get paid unless they actually deliver units, that was sort of the fail-safe in all of this. Was FEMA and the other federal agency says is, look, if we don't get the goods, we're not going to cut the checks. So the taxpayers are protected. Well, in this case, Phillicat started getting paid almost right away because they started delivering something. What that something was so the soda bottles you buy in the store, whether it's a 20-ounce or a 2-liter, those start out as what are called preforms, soda bottle preforms. That are much, much smaller. They're about the size of test tubes that you would use in like high school chemistry, a little bit oversized. And then when they're hooked up to certain machinery, they're expanded out to the size that you see in stores. Phillicat, and Phillicat's not the only one using this, this type of preform for this purpose, but Phillicat was buying millions of these. Which are much, much cheaper than the vials that are normally used for any kind of testing for viruses, and putting in a saline solution to preserve. And they were doing this they were assembling these in a warehouse north of Houston with dozens of employees, some of whom weren't wearing masks. Many of them were not wearing gloves in totally unsanitary conditions, certainly not far less than sterile. And they were producing them in a huge, huge volume. And as soon as they reached FEMA, FEMA says it was checking to make sure that the tubes weren't leaking. And when they weren't leaking, they just shipped them on to all 50 states. And when we were checking with the individual state health departments about what is this that you're receiving and does this work for you guys and does it meet the sterility requirements, the first problem is the state health departments were telling us, well, they don't fit into our lab equipment or the lab equipment of our partners. So, you know, if a sample is put in these tubes, you can't then put the tubes into the testing equipment to be analyzed to determine whether or not the virus is there or not. Beyond that, the fact that they were being assembled in hugely unsanitary conditions with people breathing into the tubes, the solution inside being left in the open air, the tubes falling on the ground and just being picked up and tossed back in, nothing being secured or kept clean or cleaned after the fact. And it's just reaching states and they don't even know what this is supposed to be or whether it's clean.
We'll have to leave it with that taste of your reporting. Ryan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Ryan Gabrielson. He's an investigative reporter for ProPublica, talking with us about his work looking into government contracts being given out for protective equipment and testing supplies during the COVID-19 pandemic. Check out his and his colleagues' reporting at ProPublica. Coming up, we'll learn about materials developed by the Sesame Workshop to help kids who have a parent in jail or prison. That's next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin is seeing a slight uptick in our positive test rate for COVID-19, and some of the biggest states in the country are dealing with major outbreaks. We'll talk to a doctor about the numbers and how we can stay safe. First, more than 5 million children in the U.S. have experienced a parent going to jail or prison. Having an incarcerated parent can be an upsetting and traumatic experience for kids who may not understand what's happening with their family. Hoping to help children and families going through this experience, the Sesame Workshop developed a new character named Alex, whose father is in jail, and materials to explain to children what's happening. Here's a listen to Alex talking about what he's going through.
It's just all this talk about my dad and where he is got me really upset.
Well, because your daddy's away?
And you miss him?
Yeah, but because of where he is, too. My dad's in jail.
In jail? Why?
I don't like to talk about it. Most people don't understand.
Actually, I do understand what you're going through. When I was about your age, my dad was incarcerated, too.
He was?
Now, a new study from UW-Madison finds that these materials help children understand their situation and make them more emotionally resilient when they visit their parent in jail. Julie Palemantainen is the Dorothy A. O'Brien Professor of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. Julie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into this newest research, you've talked to us in the past about the work you've done with Sesame Workshop. Can you tell us about the kind of resources that are being made available for kids who have incarcerated parents?
They launched an effort in 2013 that included a new Muppet named Alex, who has an incarcerated father, and they built the resources around that Muppet and then also real kids who've experienced parental incarceration. And they have videos that include Alex and his friends and discussing things about parental incarceration and his feelings and his Muppet friends supporting him. They also have interviews with real kids. They have an animated visit to an incarceration, incarcerated facility. They also have some great information for caregivers, like tips on helping children be resilient and how to connect with incarcerated parents in a way that's positive for kids. And the thing that's like really significant for this study, how to talk to really little kids about a parent's incarceration.
Let's get into that now. I could see a lot of different approaches to, you know, for the parent who's not incarcerated or grandparent or other guardian, the parent who is incarcerated, on how to talk about this. What is the approach that you take, you and Sesame take in the materials for how to talk to kids about that incarcerated parent?
Yes, Sesame Workshop bases their materials on research. And so the research has shown that when young kids are told just a developmentally appropriate, simple, honest explanation about why the parent is gone, that they show more secure attachment to their caregivers, and in general, their socio-emotional development is more positive. And that can include something like, well, we think that maybe your parent broke a law, which is a grown-up rule, and, you know, we don't know yet, but we're waiting to find things out. Or if you know, you can go into a little bit more detail, but not going into detail about, like, the crime or why. And when a really young kid says, like, they hear that and they're like, well, why? They really, they're not savvy enough to really realize that incarceration exists to, like, you know, punish people or detain them or whatever. They're more like, they're asking, like, what is incarceration? So explaining to them that, you know, it's a place where people are that they can't leave, and we're waiting to see what, you know, what happens. So reassuring the child also that the parent is safe and that the parent still loves them are also important in talking to them.
Let's get into your latest research now. What did you do? What were you trying to figure out here?
Well, the materials had been out since 2013, and actually we started this study right before the materials were released, and so we didn't think that they would be like widely available at the time, but we really wanted to test, do these materials help kids? Do they help children's caregivers know how to talk to kids about the parents' incarceration, and are children who are told about the parents' incarceration more likely to have some kind of like positive or less negative visit with the incarcerated parent? So to test that, we sampled families in two states, Minnesota and Wisconsin, and we had four jails participating. And we sampled families where the kid was coming to visit, and we randomized the kids, so we kind of randomly assigned them to whether or not they would be exposed to the Sesame Street materials or just an other condition, which was like they could either be watching a Sesame Street video about the weather or just coloring, you know, so something they were doing something, but it wasn't the Sesame Street materials. And those kids were put on a waitlist control. So those families eventually got the materials. But and then we observed the kids during their visit in the jail, from the time they walked in, through waiting, through their visit. And then we followed up with the children's caregivers by phone 2 weeks later and 4 weeks later, just to see how they were using the materials. Did they like them? Did they have any, were there any gaps? And then we also asked the incarcerated parent that, you know, they weren't allowed to have like the CD that went with the materials or get the materials online, but they were allowed to see like a sheet and then just kind of look at the caregiver guide. And they rated the materials for how appealing they were, how much they offered positive tips on contacting, communicating with children during their incarceration.
We're talking to Julie Pelman-Tynan from UW-Madison's Center for Human Ecology, looking at material she's worked on with Sesame Workshop to help kids who have parents who are incarcerated, and some of the latest research she's done on that. So, Julie, what did you find? What kind of impact did this material have?
Well, the most positive finding, I think, is that it really helped caregivers find the words to talk to children and help them to be more comfortable. And that was actually, you know, a pretty large effect. And caregivers would say things like, I didn't talk about it before because I didn't really know what they would understand. I didn't really have the words. And now we talk about it and things are more comfortable. Or, you know, if they couldn't find the words, they would say, well, when my kid asked about it, I would put in the videos and they would just like watch, and then they felt more free to ask me questions. And so I think that was the most important finding of the study, that really did do what we intended, and that it really helped people feel more comfortable discussing these issues with young kids. Because when they're, when, you know, highly stigmatized information is kept a secret, sometimes kids that become aware that there's a secret, and it makes them feel anxious or insecure. And so this way, it was really helping kids kind of like know that their parent is in a place that, you know, some families before had told the kids that the parent was like at work or at college, or they just didn't say anything. And I remember one little girl walking into the corrections facility who hadn't been, she had been told that her dad was at work, and she walked into the jail and said, "Mommy, this isn't daddy's work. He works with trees and there are no trees here." And really the sense of like betrayal and anger in that child's voice said a lot. Like, why didn't you tell me the truth? And so that was the second thing that was important that we found, that when families followed those recommendations about telling the simple developmental truth about the parents' incarceration, the kids had a little bit more positive visit. And I think that's really important, because so many families, they think it, you know, they're doing it out of love for the child. You know, they don't want to put this heavy information on a child, especially when it's highly stigmatized. And so they might, you know, make a softer story, or they, you know, might not say anything. But really what we're finding is that just being honest can strengthen family communication and security in the kids.
So let's talk about advice for people out there. And there's a lot, millions of kids have a parent who has or has or who is or has been incarcerated at some point. Can you share some advice? We'll put up a link to the material, of course, but share some advice for the parents or other relatives in that situation for how to talk to maybe a younger child about that incarcerated parent.
Sure. Well, the first thing is just knowing that the child and the family, you're not alone. There are so many people in our country affected by incarceration that it's become, sadly, a fairly common experience. A recent national survey found that 1 in 2 Americans had a close family member incarcerated, and that included either their children, their spouse, or their parent or sibling. So it's become incredibly common. And so one of the messages in the materials, and there's a beautiful song in the video that the refrain is, "You are not alone." So that's a really important message. Another message of the materials is that you know, it's okay to talk to kids about it. And, you know, if they ask really hard questions, it's okay to say when you don't know. Like sometimes they'll ask, oh, when is daddy coming home? And if you don't know, it's okay to say like, well, I don't really know, but I'll let you know as soon as I can. So it's just okay to be honest, even if you don't have all the answers. And then the other thing that seems to be really important for kids and a protective factor is facilitating children's communication with the incarcerated parent. And we found in numerous studies by my lab, but also nationally and internationally, that when kids have positive contact with the incarcerated parent, you know, not when there's been, you know, child abuse and things like that, but, you know, when it's appropriate, that the child, you know, does better. They're able to, you know, feel loved. They're able to think of themselves, you know, positively, think of their parent positively. And that's really important for a child's development to have those relationships and know that the people around them support that. So we found that. And you know, child-friendly face-to-face visits are the best. You can, you know, where they can hug and see each other. But like now, especially during the time of coronavirus, those kind of visits are pretty much stopped. And so then, you know, we've also found that video visits can be helpful. Writing letters can be helpful. Talking on the phone. Little kids are notoriously bad at that. But if they're really scaffolded by adults, you know, and that the adult is sort of narrating their play and helping them along, then it can be okay. So I think those are the key messages ways that, you know, we're recommending to caregivers and other adults to support these kids.
Julie, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Yeah, thanks for time on your show, and I hope you all have a good day.
Julie Palmentinen is the Dorothy A. O'Brien Professor of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. She joined us today to talk about educational materials developed by the Sesame Workshop and how they can help kids cope with having a parent in jail. You can find a link to the Coping with Incarceration materials from the Sesame Workshop at WPR.org. Coming up, we'll talk to a doctor about the trends we're seeing in COVID-19 numbers and safety precautions we should still be taking. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday at 6 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer Kent and her guests look at the latest news on the opioid crisis here in Wisconsin. That's Monday morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, Wisconsin's Department of Health Services reported 464 more cases of COVID-19 yesterday. The state's average rate of positive tests has gone up more than a percentage point from mid-June. DHS says 22 Wisconsin counties have high levels of coronavirus activity. That comes as big states like California, Florida, and Texas are dealing with major outbreaks and putting reopening plans on hold until they get cases under control. Dr. Jonathan Tempte is Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He's chair of the Wisconsin Council on Immunization Practices. Dr. Tempte, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you, Rob. It's a pleasure to join you on this stormy afternoon.
Yes, it is indeed. Now, what is standing out to you, first of all, with the numbers here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think everywhere we look, the case count is going up. Dane County had a fairly substantial increase in the last 24 hours of 76 cases. State of Wisconsin had 520 new cases. So we're seeing things just unfortunately increase instead of decrease.
And now we're seeing reports around the country, big states, the Texases, Californias, Floridas, around the world, seeing lots of cases, setting records, cutting back or dialing back their reopening plans. What's going on out there?
Well, I think we're seeing the same thing everywhere. First and foremost, this is a very tenacious virus. It is with us. It's not going away. If you look at the pattern across the entire United States, you find that in March and April, there was this rapid acceleration upward. We hit a peak. We gradually came down. We plateaued at the end of May, and now we are starting to explode again. It's really accelerating, and we're getting to levels that are higher than we reached at the peak in April. And I think all this comes along with our complacency and thinking that, oh, we've gotten through this. We're backing away from all those tried-and-true things that we know work, including face masking, social distancing, good hand hygiene, and just being smart.
There was a stretch where this following statement was probably true. We're only seeing bigger numbers because we're doing more testing. A month ago, that might have been accurate. Is that the story right now, though?
Well, indeed, we are doing more and more testing, but the concerning part is that of late, we're finding the positivity rate of testing going up here in Dane County and across the state. We're seeing this occurring across other jurisdictions and other states across the country as well. So whereas we're seeing more testing going on, we're actually seeing more cases and we're seeing more hospitalizations. Fortunately, so far in Wisconsin, we're doing pretty well.
Talking to Dr. Jonathan Temte from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the latest news and numbers when it comes to COVID-19 in Wisconsin and around the country. You mentioned hospitals being overwhelmed. I wanted to quote from this piece that appeared in the New York Times by a Dr. Bradley Dreyfus, emergency physician at the University of Arizona. He writes about health workers being overwhelmed there, like we were seeing in New York City earlier. I'm going to quote. He says, I'm willing to sacrifice for the greater good of the public. I took an oath to that effect when I became a physician, but the public has to sacrifice some too if we want to get through this as safely as possible. So that's somebody who's in the midst of it in another hotspot, Arizona. Can you talk about that message he had for the public there?
Well, absolutely. When we're making decisions not only for ourselves, but for everyone else out there. I now find myself in a demographic where by age alone, I'm considered at higher risk. That being said, I'm very careful when I go out to wear a mask, and that's primarily to protect other people around. I could be harboring this virus without knowing it, and doing my duty and out of respect for my other community dwellers, I'm willing to take that little bit of inconvenience so that we all might be a little bit healthier.
The White House Coronavirus Task Force gave its first briefing in quite a while today. I want to listen to Dr. Anthony Fauci talking about states that have generally seen their numbers decline and haven't had major problems yet.
They are vulnerable. If we don't extinguish the outbreak, sooner or later, even ones that are doing well are going to be vulnerable to the spread. So we need to take that into account because we are all in it together. And the only way we're going to end it is by ending it together.
And it seems like, yeah, we've got this whack-a-mole situation. My state is doing okay now. We relax the restrictions, but it pops up over there. They get tougher. It comes over here. Then we have to get tougher. Why is it so hard to coordinate this nationwide?
Well, I think the thing going on is this is a virus which will take opportunities where they're offered. Where we are less careful, where we let down our guard, it'll pop up. And without having a comprehensive national approach to this, we're going to see the patchwork of state-to-state, county-to-county approaches. And with this virus as widespread as it is right now, there's no going back. We just have to be responsible and do the things that we know will at least slow things down.
Let's get to some specifics here. I was looking at some of the projections. I think this is the one out of University of Washington. I could be wrong, but they showed two different projections. One, we keep going kind of like we are now. One, we get really good at wearing masks. A difference in deaths by October of 40,000. Masks can really make that big a difference?
Masks can really make that big of a difference. There have been some very good studies now looking both at masking and at distancing, and both are really quite effective. Heard a comment earlier today about if there was a treatment out there that would lower the risk of you coming down with this by 80%, would you take it? A lot of people would. Well, a mask can do that. Likewise, maintaining that social distancing has an equally strong effect, particularly at that 6-foot perimeter. This can really have an enormous effect and help slow this on down. And without these, I fear we're going to start seeing things accelerate again. I have to go back to my favorite modeling paper that was published in April of this year. And what we're seeing right now is basically what was predicted in that paper if we relaxed on the social distancing and the public health measures. We're kind of getting right back to where we were. And unfortunately, the consequences going back to the closures of businesses and various activities, which harm all of us.
I want to bring up something that's been all over social media. There's video of people bringing this up, even in, you know, city council meetings where they're talking about mask mandates. People raising the concern, the belief that if you wear a mask, you can get carbon dioxide poisoning. Can you explain that idea to us and what we know?
Well, the masks are very permeable to molecules of oxygen and carbon dioxide. They freely diffuse out. So unless you're undergoing very, very heavy exercise, there is no credence to that. I think back to my days as a medical student scrubbing into some of the skin grafting cases, which might go on for 12 hours, and being in a mask for most of that, and coming out feeling really hot, but otherwise unscathed.
Right. We have people whose line of work involves wearing masks for long periods of time. This carbon dioxide thing, not an issue.
Not an issue.
We're talking to Dr. John Tempte, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at some of the latest news, numbers, and developments in the COVID-19 pandemic. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about where things are headed with the coronavirus? Do you have thoughts on or questions about transmission, safety measures, the numbers you're seeing? Are you doing things like wearing a mask when you leave your home, when you go into, say, businesses or visit with people? Have you changed your lifestyle back to the old normal? Are you living in a new normal or somewhere in between? If you're working in healthcare yourself, what are you seeing? What do you want to see from the public? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Dr. Jonathan Tempte from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the latest on the COVID-19 numbers here in Wisconsin and around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about the numbers we're seeing, what they mean, how things are trending? Are you concerned about people not taking safety measures in public? Are you still putting activities on hold? If you're in healthcare yourself, what are you seeing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. We have Elizabeth on the line in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi. I just had a quick question. I went to the doctor's office. My husband found an N95 downstairs. Apparently, I guess it's a construction N95. The doctor's office said, no, you have to wear one of our masks. That's not protecting us because it's expelling. I guess it allows for breathing. So I was wondering, and they gave me a paper mask. Should I wear the paper mask under the N95? I'm confused now what to do.
Elizabeth, thanks for calling. I think Elizabeth's probably not alone in confusion over the different masks out there, Dr. Tempte.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, Elizabeth. A lot of the N95 masks that you can purchase, for example, at the hardware store, will have a vent in it, so when you exhale, the air goes out really easily. It filters things coming to you, but doesn't filter anything going out. And the concern from the healthcare center is for all those other patients who are in the waiting room, and for the healthcare providers, the medical assistants, the nurses, the laboratory staff, and so on. And so the protocols are set to use that surgical mask, which we know will prevent the transmission of respiratory droplets if you cough, sneeze, or talk loudly. And this will kind of protect those people around you. You're correct in the assumption that that's not going to protect you so much, But if you go into your clinics, you'll find that all the medical staff there are wearing masks. They're typically wearing a shield as well. And we know that those two together are very, very effective in preventing in transmission.
Thanks for that call, Elizabeth. We heard from a caller named Courtney calling from Appleton, who says, as a manager at a grocery store, Courtney sees the general public going back to the original way of operating, seeing little mask wearing, large groups, lots of regulars coming in and out. I know one of my grocery stores has been saying over a loudspeaker, try to limit one trip per week. Have we gone back to the old ways of doing things too fast, Dr. Tempty, as Courtney is observing?
Yeah, I think we have. The big thing out there is the possibility of transmission with virtually any encounter. And what we know more about this virus is that for early on, after you're infected and start producing your own levels of virus, many people are going to be asymptomatic or have low symptoms, so things that they don't even recognize as illness. Some people actually go through the entire illness without ever feeling sick. Some people, unfortunately, get a whole lot sicker. But we never quite know who might be carrying this and at what time. And so the best approach right now, especially as we're seeing things accelerate, is to be very precautionary and assume the worst, assume that you might be carrying this, and think of those other people around you. And in particular, even if you're interacting with younger people, realize those younger people have exposure to parents, to grandparents, to infants, and other people who might be vulnerable to this virus.
Let's go to another caller now. Janet is with us in Elgin, Illinois. Janet, hi.
Yes, I've been going to stores where people don't cover their noses with their masks. And I say something to them, but sometimes they get belligerent.
Dr. Tempty, covering the mouth but not the nose with a mask.
Yeah, and the mask is designed for both the nose and the mouth. We know that by the sheer act of breathing, we can push out particles containing virus. And if you have to stop and think for a second, when people make virus, they're making billions and billions of copies of this virus. It's not just a little, it's a whole lot. And the more we can stem the tide of that virus coming out and having transmission, the more all of us are going to do better. And the sooner, for example, our economy can come back to a more normal state.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Dennis now in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. When I go out shopping, I'm wondering, well, since I'm running out of alcohol, when I clean off milk cartons and packages of frozen foods, would a freezer necessarily dry out the coronaviruses, or would they just kind of die? And what about my clothes? Am I supposed to launder my clothes after every time I go out?
Dennis, thanks a lot for that call. And Dr. Tempty, there was a lot of concern early on about the surfaces and wiping down everything with alcohol wipes. What is the latest on that we know about transmission via, like, that milk carton or the clothes you wear to the grocery store?
Well, I'm far more concerned about that respiratory droplet spread than I am about surfaces. And indeed, if somebody coughs and there are droplets of saliva or other respiratory droplets that stay on the surface, yeah, the virus can stay alive for some time. And for example, on clothing and porous things, it's actually a very, very short time. Things like some plastics and impermeable, it can stay longer. So if you're really concerned, the simple act of putting that milk carton in the refrigerator and not touching it for 8 hours, you should be fine. But for the most part, we're not particularly concerned anymore about that surface spread. It's much more that person-to-person through respiratory transmission.
Thanks a lot for that call, Dennis. We're talking to Dr. Jonathan Tempty from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the latest on COVID-19. Let's talk about that respiratory transmission and where it happens. I've seen looks out west trying to say, hey, are we seeing more cases because of protests or because of parties and bars? In Dane County, there's concern about businesses near UW-Madison, which I think means bars. Do we know about the types of events that seem to be likely to spread and maybe even super spread the virus?
Well, there are a number of good case examples now of spread within closed confined spaces, especially when you have gatherings of many people. So a bar situation definitely is a risk. Things like, unfortunately, churches are a risk where people are in close proximity, and particularly if they're singing and so on and close together. The bottom line is, with this virus, we tend to think of the length of time you're near somebody and the proximity. So if I'm out walking, I have an office fairly close to Vilas Park, and if I'm walking down the trail and there's someone coming past me and we pass, I'm not really concerned about that brief encounter, but it's a factor of the amount of time and the closeness that you are. And so when we're packed together, we really don't even like that. But if you can't avoid at least close contact for a little bit, you know, use that mask and expect the others around you to use that mask.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Alex is with us in Hartford. Alex, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Alex?
Good. The point I wanted to bring out is that, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on wearing masks. And also some of the guidance is to not touch your face, especially your eyes, since they are very vulnerable. So the question is, isn't the virus floating around in air? Aren't the eyes susceptible to catching the virus right through your eyes?
Interesting, Dr. Tepti. Do we know about the virus transmission via our eyes?
Well, that's a very good question, and it is certainly possible. I don't know of any absolute studies that says yes or no, but there's anecdotal evidence that this may happen. On the other hand, walking through a room that there have been people in is actually pretty low risk. On the other hand, if you're close to somebody and there's a cough, sneeze, or a respiratory droplet that lands in your eye, that person's infected, there's a very good likelihood that transmission will occur. And that's why we find in medical settings, and when I'm in clinic, I'm in my mask, I'm in my face shield, and that's protecting me. I also wear glasses, so I'm protected in numerous ways for both my eyes, my nose, and my mouth. Also, when you go into a medical setting, you find that we're fastidious about washing our hands. Well, either using soap and water for 20 to 30 seconds or using the gel when we come into the room, when we leave a room, when we come back into the room. So all these things together we know are beneficial, but we have to kind of keep this up for the long game. We're in this for the long haul, I'm afraid, and I don't see any good simple fixes coming anytime soon.
And in our last few minutes, Dr. Tepti, I wanted to ask about, you know, we're testing more, we're doing some contact tracing. Part three is supposed to be isolate. Do we know if when people have that positive diagnosis, if they're trying to limit their contact with others?
Well, we do know that if you are positive, you're going to be shedding virus for somewhere around 7 to 10 days. We can find the traces of the virus much, much longer with our molecular techniques called polymerase chain reaction. But in terms of contagiousness, this is probably limited to no more than about 2 weeks. So most of the recommendations for isolation, if you're positive, is for about 2 weeks. There's also quarantining, which we use for people who are exposed and we don't know whether or not they're positive. But with more and more testing available, we can get people out of quarantine if they have a negative test.
We'll leave it there for now. Dr. Tepti, as always, thanks for joining us.
Well, and thank you, too, and have a wonderful weekend.
You, too. That's Dr. Jonathan Tepti, Associate Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He was with us to talk about the rising positive test rate for COVID-19 here in Wisconsin and elsewhere in the country. You can let us know what questions you have about coronavirus by going to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Coming up Monday on Central Time, the national debt was growing big time even before the COVID-19 pandemic, and relief spending is boosting it even more. But an economist tells us don't worry so much about the deficit spending. And the Trump administration filed a brief with the U.S. Supreme Court asking it to completely overturn the Affordable Care Act. We'll find out what that would mean and when the court is actually going to consider that. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time. weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. It's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Monday at 7:30, Wisconsin Assembly Speaker Robin Voss joins the show with his reactions to protests in Madison and more. That's Monday at 7:30 on the morning show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll find out how to make ice cream at home without buying lots of fancy equipment. That's on this week's edition of Food Friday. Get some recipes. Get started right now. WPR.org/Food Friday. I'm Rob Barrett. This is Central Time.